This Thursday and Friday night at the Tennessee Theater at 7:30, the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra will perform A Timeless Romance as part of the Moxley Carmichael Masterwork Series. Aram Demersian, what does that mean, timeless romance?
We plan these seasons over a year in advance, and you know, when you look down the calendar and see that your February Masterworks concerts fall on February 14th and February 15th, well, that's an opportunity that you really can't let slip away, because I don't say this tongue-in-cheek, I can't think of a more romantic Valentine's date than to take your date to a concert of just absolutely gorgeous orchestral music. I mean, we love classical music because it gives us the opportunity to get lost in our own emotions. And the timeless aspect of it is because you have repertoire and stories featured on tonight's program that truly are timeless, whether it is Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, which is in the pantheon of pieces of famous and much beloved classical music. You have a slightly sideways take on Romeo and Juliet in the piece by Delius, which is called The Walk to Paradise Garden from his opera A Village, Romeo and Juliet. The story of Romeo and Juliet as though they were peasant folk rather than the children of families of nobility. And then you have a very, very dramatic piece by Manuel de Falla called El Amor Brujo, Love the Magician, which is kind of, it's not really even a love triangle, it's a love quadrangle, but the crux of the story is you have a widow who has met a new love, but she's being haunted by the ghost of her dead husband. You know, so it's three wonderful pieces, and I think also just the idea of a love story is timeless in a way. I mean, you look at every love story kind of breaks down at the end of the day to the same essential elements. You know, you've got a central couple, you've got conflict, you may have a couple of other people in the mix. And I think our program tells three very distinct musical love stories and three very distinctive musical styles. But there's commonalities that run throughout. And, you know, as I've been preparing for this program, the more time I spend with all of these pieces, they start to sound more and more like they're of the same voice, in spite of the surface level differences in the vocabulary of the composers.
I watched recently a film version of El Amor Brujo, and it was really fascinating. Well, there are actually a couple different film versions of it. Can you tell me why this one made the cut? I mean, I can see Swan Lake. That's easy. Why did this one make the cut?
This one made the cut because I love this piece. This is a party piece for me. It's one of those pieces that a lot of people haven't heard. There aren't many people in the KSO that have played it before this week, actually. I think I discovered it because of the most famous movement from it, which is the Ritual Fire Dance. That's the movement that I knew before anything else, and that's a 4-minute. I mean, it's basically an encore. It's so famous. But I knew about the Ritual Fire Dance, and as we do, we research repertoire. We try to just, you know, learn about as much music as we can, and we listen to recordings. And I became curious about, you know, where did this movement come from? And, you know, listened to the entire ballet suite and just fell in love with the music. And it's a really wonderful piece. It's pretty concise. It's about 24 minutes long. And there are so many different ways that you can perform it. I mean, you mentioned that you've seen film versions of it. It was conceived of as originally as a pantomime and then kind of became a ballet. But it's very distinctive as ballets go also, because you've got the orchestra. We're going to have dancers from Appalachian Ballet Company who are going to be doing a new choreography of it. But then also, you know, something that you don't find in ballets too often, you have a singer that is featured as well, who occasionally gives voice to the, you know, to the dramatic underpinning, or I guess almost inner monologue of the main character, and that is going to be performed by my good friend Solange Mardinian, who is a Argentinian Armenian living in America now, who's just one of the, you know, most one of my favorite up and coming voices in the classical music world.
You know, you said that a lot of members of the orchestra haven't played this particular piece of music before. Does that naturally take more work, or do they get really excited, like, "Ooh, here's something I haven't done," or "Oh no, I've never done it before"?
Yes. No, I think a little bit of all three, and you encounter all three of those a little bit as you go, as you traverse the rehearsal process. You know, certainly. I don't think that with a new piece of music, I don't think that there's an intimidation factor or anything like that. But there's certainly, you know, discoveries that happen, as you go through the rehearsal week, and there are challenges that you don't necessarily face when you're doing a piece that, you know, people have performed, you know, every 3 or 4 years or so. But I think most of all, people are just kind of excited because it's really good music, and they're having a good time adding this to their own musical vocabulary.
One thing I've been really trying differently when I come out to see performances, I'm wondering, as a conductor, if you go see a concert, where do you like to sit?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, it depends on the hall. It depends on the hall that I'm in. I mean, there really isn't a bad seat in the house in the Tennessee Theater. That's not true for every concert hall. There are definitely concert halls that have bad seats. So you know what? Really, it depends on the hall. If I'm at the Boston Symphony, Symphony Hall Boston, I like to sit in the orchestra section about halfway back because of how I perceive the acoustics of that particular hall. If I'm at David Geffen Hall, the New York Philharmonic, man, the acoustic is different in every seat in that house. So I like to be in one of the balconies up as close to the stage as possible, because you get the full power of the orchestra. And I could just keep on running down the list with every hall that I've sat in, and the answer is different for everyone, because every hall is unique. And the acoustic idiosyncrasies are, they're just something that you have to discover for yourself over time, the more time you spend in a space.
Have you been in Disney Hall?
I have not been in Disney Hall. However, I have spent a lot of time in what I guess you could call Disney's sister hall, which is Helzberg Hall in Kansas City, where I worked for 4 years. Helzberg Hall is basically... It was designed by the same acoustician as Disney Hall, Yasu Toyoda, and he actually has said that Helzberg Hall was, for him, acoustically an improvement on Disney Hall. It's about a two-thirds size Disney Hall. Disney Hall is about 2,300 seats. This is about 1,600 seats, and I've conducted in that space quite a lot. I've sat as an audience member in the space quite a lot, and it's fabulous. It's one of the best acoustics in the country. It also, has idiosyncrasies of its own. And, I like to sit in, one of the upper balcony seats in that hall, because the way that particular acoustician designed it is he actually wanted the highest seat in the house to be the best mix of sound that you could get. But even on a stage acoustically, it sounds different depending on where you are. Stages have certain hot spots and they have certain dead spots also. And as performers, the same way a pitcher in baseball kind of learns their home mound, just how the dirt falls, how the plant of the foot. That as performers, we learn the stage.
By the way, I follow your Twitter feed. Congratulations again on both the World Series and the Super Bowl.
That's very big of you. I mean, yes, as listeners may or may not know, I was born and raised, grew up just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Still a proud Bostonian at heart, and was steeped in the culture of sports there. So we've had a good year.
Great. And I don't like the Dodgers especially, so I'm actually happy for you and happy for me.
Yeah, and both times against L.A. teams. I'd say I feel for L.A., but, you know, they're doing all right.
Yeah, they'll be okay. The Knoxville Symphony performs Timeless Romance Thursday and Friday at the Tennessee Theater. It begins at 7:30. And for this performance, if someone is under the age of 18, they get in free with one adult purchase. How does that work?
That is right, Todd. The Knoxville Symphony, along with many, many other performing arts nonprofits in the community, participates in the Penny for the Arts program. If there is an adult that is already purchasing a ticket to a Knoxville Symphony performance and they are bringing somebody who is under 18, then that ticket is, well, it's a penny. It's essentially free if you call ahead.
For WUOT, I'm Todd Steed. Thanks to our guest, Aram Demersian.